Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Thursday, April 4th. I'm your reader, Will Potter. Let's start off with the article, Reynolds, AEA Changes is a Place to Start. Recently enacted changes to Iowa's area education agencies, which provide special education services and other supports to public schools, represent a phenomenal place to start, Governor Kim Reynolds said Wednesday. Reynolds earlier this year proposed overhauling the structure and funding of Iowa's 9 AEAs, and this past week she signed into law such a proposal, albeit one that was not as sweeping as her original pitch. Area education agencies oversee education of Iowa students with disabilities and offer media and consulting services to schools and students in their boundaries. During a news conference Wednesday in the governor's formal office at the Iowa Capitol, Reynolds was asked whether she is satisfied with the new AEA law or whether she will bring another legislative proposal for the 2025 legislative session. I'm happy with what the bill ended up. Really, it was a phenomenal place to start, Reynolds said. I thought it was a fair and reasonable place where they ended up. Reynolds said a review of the state's AEA system was needed, and that she found in the system a lack of consistency, transparency, and accountability. So there were some really good places for us to start, Reynolds said, and this comprehensive bill takes a really promising step forward to start to do all that. Reynolds said that she will continue to speak with public school and AEA leaders moving forward. She said her proposal was never intended to do away with the AEA system, but rather to provide transparency, accountability, consistency, and to improve students' outcomes. We're building relationships and we're understanding additional things that we can look at, like categorical funding, providing more flexibility, Reynolds said. What the new law will do. Currently, federal and state special education funding goes directly to the 9 agencies. AEA also receive property tax funding from media services and other education services for schools in their region. Once the new law is fully implemented in the second year, 10% of state funding for special education services will remain with school districts for them to use, while 90% will continue to flow directly to the AEAs. In the second year, all state funding for other education services and media services will go directly to schools, which could use that money for AEA services or get them from another entity. The law also creates a division in the Iowa Department of Education, up to 53 new full-time equivalent positions to provide oversight of special education services provided by the AEAs. Now let's move on to a different article. Keys to recover after crash. Family corgi important to returning to normal. If his younger sister had her way, Alex Lopez said that she would push the fast-forward button on her recovery to get back to where she was before November 11th, 2023. That night, Angie Lopez was struck by a motorcycle on historic 4th Street in Sioux City. The 24-year-old University of Nebraska at Omaha kinesiology undergraduate suffered a traumatic brain injury and broken bones. Life as she knew it stopped, and in the days, weeks, and months following the crash, Angie has had to cope with a new normal. Angie spent a month in the intensive care unit at Mercy One Sioux in Medical Center, where she underwent a craniotomy to relieve pressure on her brain. After she became more alert, she was transferred to Madonna Rehabilitation Hospital's Omaha campus, where she participated in intensive therapy to regain her strength, coordination, and cognition. Angie had to relearn how to walk and talk. Now back in her family's South Sioux City home, Angie pushes her body to its limits during twice-weekly physical therapy sessions. She also attends speech and occupational therapy 3 times a week. When she's on her feet and moving around, Angie wears a white helmet, which will protect her brain if she ever were to lose her balance and fall. She has to undergo an operation to replace the bone flap on her skull and is potentially facing anterior cruciate ligament surgery. She's very independent. She's always been the person who said, I'm going to do this on my own. I'll figure it out. I'll get through this. She's strong-willed for sure, Alex said on a Thursday evening in mid-March as he sat next to his sister on the brownish-gray reclining love seat in their parents' living room. Angie's Welsh corgi, Mojo, watched intently from the dining room through the glass panes of French doors. Before the crash, Angie worked at a physical therapy clinic and a men's clinic in Omaha. She had plans to enroll in a program to earn her doctorate of physical therapy and was waiting to hear back from a handful of schools she applied to. I was going to graduate and then I would work with little kids. They're cute, said Angie, who now struggles at times to express herself due to aphasia, a comprehension and communication disorder that impacts a person's ability to understand both written and spoken language or formulate proper responses. Little kids need help, just like me. Angie's mom, Lily, calls her daughter a miracle. She said Angie tells her daily she wants to move back to Omaha with Mojo. Alex and his sister knows her way around and even says she wants to drive. He thinks Angie is tired of the family, kind of babying her. Angie agreed, nodding her head and responding with, yep. Angie enjoys spending time alone with Mojo. With a treat in her hand, she instructed the tan and white pooch to sit down and then spin around. Mojo complied. But when Angie asked him to circle a second time, Mojo turned and walked away, his little feet pitter-patter on the clear plastic floor runner. Every morning, she says the same thing, and that she wants to get better, and that she wants to leave with her dog, Lily said. There are days, I think, she gets sad. Maybe she remembers how she was. Here's a subheader. It says, come now. The morning of November 11th, Angie told her mom that she wanted to go to the 1008 Keys Club that evening with her friend Jeline. Later on, after Angie's dad, Israel, grilled steaks and the family visited with relatives, Lily and Israel offered to take Angie and Jeline to historic 4th Street. According to the Sioux City Police Department, at 11:18 p.m., a Suzuki motorcycle driven by 27-year-old Anthony M. Simmons was eastbound in the 1000 block of 4th Street when it collided with Angie, who was walking southbound across 4th Street. Alex said Angie exited the back driver's side of her family's black Acura TLX, which was facing west, and took a step forward. She was immediately struck by the motorcycle. Lily recalled hearing a huge sound. My husband and I, we got out of the car. He yelled at me and said it was Angie, Lily said, voice quaking. As her eyes welled with tears, I had sandals on and I ran. Alex, who is listed as Angie's emergency contact on her iPhone, was at home playing video games with a friend when he received an emergency text alert. As he was unlocking his cell phone to read the text, his father called, with the emergency sirens wailing in the background. Alex could hardly make sense of what Israel was saying. He heard the word accident, 4th Street, and come now. When Alex arrived at the scene, he saw a crowd of people and Angie on the ground. His mom was crying, and his dad was pacing back and forth. Alex said the driver of the motorcycle was leaning up against a police cruiser. According to a search warrant application, which was filed November 12th in Woodbury County District Court, witnesses said they observed Simmons of Omaha, a papa wheelie with the motorcycle, which was traveling at a high rate of speed right before hitting Angie. Sioux City police have yet to file any charges against Simon, who refused a breath sample. The search warrant application noted that Simon had bloodshot, watery eyes and the strong odor of an alcoholic beverage on his breath. It lists Angie's injuries as being traumatic brain injury, bruised lungs, a skull fracture, and a broken clavicle. Alex said that both of her legs were injured, as was her right hand. In February, Sioux City Community Policing Sergeant Tom Gill said the department received a toxicology report from the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation, but was waiting for testing to come back on the motorcycle. Last week, Gill told the Journal about the toxicology report showed Simon's blood tested above the legal limit for alcohol. He said the Woodbury County Attorney's Office is waiting for paperwork from Angie's family before formally charging Simon. Alex said that he has been in contact with an officer about signing a medical release form. Another subheader, Turning Point. Sioux City Fire Rescue's EMS team rushed Angie to Mercy One Siouxland Medical Center, where she was placed on life support. The hospital is located just a few blocks northwest of the crash site. Alex said he is thankful for the quick actions of medical professionals that night, which played a huge part not only in Angie's survival, but how far she has subsequently come in her recovery. Time was key, he said. How fast they responded, how quickly they got her to Mercy. The doctor told us that played a huge part in how the results are turning out. The Lopez family basically lived at the hospital while Angie fought for her life in the intensive care unit. Alex said amazing nurses tended to his sister. He specifically remembered one of them washing Angie's face and calling her the princess the night she was admitted. Lily's family traveled to Sioux City from California. Angie's cousin, Yvonne, whom Angie's particularly close with, regularly fixed Angie's hair and eyelashes and manicured her nails while she was in a coma. We were never alone because a lot of people visited Angie at the hospital, Lily said. It was really sad for us what happened, but at the same time, we had a lot of support. Angie's a very lucky girl because everybody loves her. Mojo even visited Angie at Mercy One. After the corgi snuggled up to her side, Alex said Angie's condition began to improve. Mojo would later make the trip to Madonna to see Angie. We 110% believe that was the turning point for Angie when she felt her dog, Alex said. It seemed like every day after she saw her dog, it was a reason for her to get going. Another subheader, reintegration. Angie doesn't remember the day of the crash. Lily said Angie's doctor thinks it's better that she has no recollection of that life-altering event. What Angie does recall is medical professionals asking what happened to her weeks after the crash. I didn't know. And sometimes I would tell them that I got into an accident, and that's it, Angie said. Abby McClure, an occupational therapist who worked with Angie at Madonna, said every brain injury is different, and each patient's progression can be unpredictable. The repetition and the early intervention, getting this patient up and moving and doing those daily tasks over and over to rewire the brain and recreate those connections, is what's really important, she said. It's the intensity that can really make a big difference. McClure said the shift from lying in a hospital bed all day to getting up at 7 a.m. at Madonna, showering and then getting right into therapy was exhausting for Angie. Over 2 months of physical and occupational therapy at Madonna, Angie transitioned from using a wheelchair to walking independently. In speech therapy, she works to overcome aphasia. McClure credits Angie's physical therapy background and the support of her family as reasons why she has been so successful in her recovery. The two women immediately developed a rapport soon after Angie arrived at Madonna. Angie has even said she hopes to one day work at Madonna alongside the therapists who helped her. She is a young adult. She's trying to get back to her life. She had so much going for her and had a plan of where she's going with her life, McClure said. I feel like I connected with her really quickly, just knowing that we were very similar people. I feel like for us, it's really helped form this bond and made her open up a lot more. McClure worked with Angie on building her core strength and balance so that Angie could once again perform basic self-care activities such as dressing and bathing. Since Angie suffered a broken collarbone, McClure said her right shoulder was quite weak. She said putting a shirt on or taking one off was suddenly really difficult for Angie. At one point, McClure put a foam block underneath Angie as she stood and reached various items on a giant touchscreen. The activity challenged Angie's cognition and her balance simultaneously. McClure said Angie had a lot of hard days because she pushed herself to her limits. She pushed herself as far as she can. Sometimes it goes over the top and she has those moments where it takes a toll on her, but it never stops her. She said, by the time Angie was ready to leave Madonna, she was walking the hallways with her mom and performing at least 95% of her self-care tasks. Angie even went to Lululemon and Starbucks with her therapists. McClure said the community reintegration and outlings seemed like a very big moment for Angie and her mom. "I was so happy there," Angie said of her favorite places. "Now it's a matter of building towards a return to work, school, and being Mojo's sole caregiver." Angie still has major hurdles to overcome, but she is determined to reclaim her life. Now let's move on to the article, "Online Sports Gambling Put on Hold." Nebraska voters won't have the chance to legalize online sports gambling this year after a coalition of the nation's biggest sportbooks opted not to back a ballot initiative campaign aimed at changing the state's constitution to allow online and mobile sport betting. FanDuel, DraftKings, BetMGM, and Caesars had partnered with Ho-Chunk Inc., the economic development arm of the Winnebago Tribe of Nebraska, to commission a public opinion poll in February gauging Nebraskans' appetite for legalized online sports gambling, as the coalition considered launching a petition drive to put a constitutional amendment on November's ballot. February's poll showed that 57% of respondents signaled support for the constitutional amendment, said Lance Morgan, the CEO of Ho-Chunk, the parent company of Warhorse Gaming, which operates physical sports books in Lincoln and Omaha. But the group of national sports betting companies that helped commission the poll has declined to fund a petition drive to put the matter to a vote this November, Morgan said, which was expected to cost between $5 million and $7 million. If you're at 57% support, it creates some possibility that you could lose unless you were to put substantial resources into it, Morgan told the Lincoln Journal Star on Monday. It doesn't make any sense to go to war unless you have a war chest lined up. The coalition would have had to conduct an ad campaign and likely hire paid petition circulators to gather roughly 122,000 ballot signatures, including 5% of registered voters and in at least 38 of Nebraska's 93 counties by July to get the issue on the 2024 general election ballot. The successful 2020 bid to legalize casino gambling in Nebraska generated more than $7 million in spending by pro- and anti-gambling forces on advertisements, lawyers, and petition circulators. The national companies are instead focusing on similar efforts in more populous states this year, Morgan said, while Ho-Chunk, which is already spending hundreds of millions of dollars on the development of casinos in Lincoln and Omaha, wasn't willing to foot the bill alone. "I think we're just on their list of these big companies, I suspect," Morgan said, suggesting Nebraska was too late to party for the companies to fund the campaign for this election cycle. "This is one of the problems, I think, of being a small population state," he said. "It's unfortunate, I think." The national company's decisions to not back a petition drive, which would have faced fierce opposition from the state's influential gambling opponents, means online sports gambling will remain outlawed in Nebraska for at least another year, if not longer. Morgan has repeatedly called on Nebraska lawmakers to legalize online betting, a move that would remove the costly burden of a ballot initiative from the casino industry, but one that remains unlikely in the state's conservative-dominated legislature. "The industry won't have another chance to take the issue directly to voters until November 2026. Our plan is very straightforward," Morgan said. "Hopefully, we can get it passed in the unicameral in the next 2 years as it becomes more sort of politically acceptable. Otherwise, I think it's almost guaranteed that it will be on the ballot in 26," he continued. "But I feel bad because this is something that everybody wants, and if we do it in 2026, we will be 4 years behind Iowa, and that's unfortunate." Iowa is among four states bordering Nebraska where online sports betting is already legal, along with Kansas, Colorado, and Wyoming. Betting on live sports was illegal in most of the United States as recently as 2018, when the Supreme Court cleared the way for states to legalize wagers on live games. In the years since, 38 states and Washington, D.C. have legalized some form of sports betting, while other states have mulled legislation to follow suit. Sports wagering was included in the three constitutional amendments overwhelmingly approved by Nebraska voters in 2020 to establish casino gambling at the state's licensed horse racing tracks. But since online gambling wasn't included in those amendments, would-be sports gamblers couldn't place sport bets in Nebraska until racetrack casinos were approved by the Racing and Gaming Commission. Warhorse Lincoln, Nebraska's first state-licensed casino, received commission approval and opened its doors in September of 2022. The casino's sportsbook didn't open for another 9 months, accepting its first bet in June 2023. Still, the prohibition on online sports gambling in Nebraska hasn't stopped state residents from doing it. Geolocation analysis conducted last year identified 64,000 mobile sports betting users' accounts in Nebraska belonging to at least some users who are crossing the state's eastern border to Iowa to place online sports bets. The analysis identified 7,804 border crossings between September 7th, when the NFL season kicked off, and October 30th last year, the Omaha World Herald reported. In 2022, in-person gamblers spent $232 million in Iowa, while bets made online totaled $2.12 billion, nine times as much. Last year, Nebraska's casinos brought in $89 million, less than $1.8 million of which came from sports betting. Now, let's go on to the article. College will cost up to $95,000 this fall. Schools say it's okay. Financial aid can numb sticker shock. As more than 2 million graduating high school students from across the United States finalize their decisions on what college to attend this fall, many are facing jaw-dropping costs, in some cases as much as $95,000. A number of private colleges, some considered elite and others middle of the pack, have exceeded the $90,000 threshold for the first time this year as they set their annual costs for tuition, board, meals, and other expenses. That means a wealthy family with three children could expect to shell out more than $1 million by the time their youngest completes a four-year degree. But the sticker price only tells part of the story. Many colleges with large endowments have become forced in recent years on making college affordable for students who aren't wealthy. Lower-income families may be required to pay just 10% of the advertised rate. For some, attending a selective private college can turn out to be cheaper than a state institution. $90,000 clearly is a lot of money, and it catches people's attention for sure, said Philip Levine, a professor of economics at Wesley College near Boston. But for most people, that's not how much they're going to pay. The existence of a very generous financial aid system lowers that cost substantially. Wesley is among the colleges where the cost for wealthy students will exceed $90,000 for the first time this fall, an estimated price tag of $92,000. But the institution points out that nearly 60% of its students will receive financial aid, and the average amount that is paid is more than $62,000, reducing their costs by two-thirds. But many prospective students this year are facing significant delays and anxiety in finding how much aid they will be offered by colleges due to major problems with the rollout of the new U.S. Department of Education online form that was supposed to make applying for federal aid easier. Many colleges rely on information from the form for determining their own aid offers to students. The rollout has been pure chaos and an absolute disaster, said Mark Krantowitz, a financial aid expert. Now, let's move on to the article, Lawmakers Advance Bill to Raise Sales Tax. With no votes to spare, Nebraska lawmakers advance a bill that would raise the state's sales tax by 1 cent to 6.5% on every taxable dollar spent, which would make it among the highest in the country. The bill is key to Republican Governor Jim Pillen's plan to slash soaring property taxes, which reached a high of $5.3 billion in 2023, as housing prices have soared in recent years. Because local assessors are required to assess residential property at around 100% of market value, some people, particularly the elderly who are on fixed incomes, are being priced out of homes they've owned for years because they can't afford the tax bill, Pillen and others have said. The bill garnered the 33 votes needed Tuesday to end a filibuster and advance the second of three rounds to debate in Nebraska's unique one-chamber legislature. In addition to raising the state's current 5.5% sales tax and expanding it to include more services, such as digital advertising costs, it would add new taxes to candy and soda pop that would hemp the CBD products at 100%. California currently has the highest state sales tax in the nation at 7.25%. If the Nebraska bill passes it, it would match the 6.5% sales tax of Arkansas and Kansas and Washington, which all currently tie for the ninth highest in the nation. Because most cities in the countries in Nebraska have an additional local sales tax from 1/2 cent to 2 cents on the dollar, the legislation advanced Tuesday would make the total sales tax in some Nebraskan cities 8.5%. But the bill would also cut sales tax currently added to utility bills, a proposal made to address complaints that a sales tax increase would disproportionately affect lower-income people. Supporters of the bill pushed back on that argument, noting that grocery food items would still be exempt from sales tax in Nebraska. The bill is aimed at higher-income residents with more disposable income, not those living in poverty, said Omaha Senator Lou Anne Lehman. For those struggling to get by, are you spending a lot of money on handbags? Linhan asked. Are you spending $200 on new shoes? This bill affects people who have money to spend on those things. Linhan has struggled to find enough votes to advance the bill and the paused debate on it last week in an effort to scrounge up more support. It appeared to be headed for failure Tuesday after initially getting only 32 votes, one short to end debate. It got a 33rd vote from Republican Senator Steve Erdman, one of the bill's biggest critics, who switched from voting to a yes vote in the last second. Erdman supports a sales tax structure that taxes virtually all purchases while eliminating property income and corporate tax. Critics of the measure included an unusual mix of both left-leaning opponents who say a sales tax inherently puts more burden on lower-income populations and conservative ones who oppose any increase in taxes. State Senator Jane Raybould, a Democrat in the officially nonpartisan Nebraska legislature, said that while food may not be subjected to sales tax, other necessities like toiletries and cleaning products and more expensive needs like kitchen appliances and vehicles will hurt lower-income Nebraska residents. Others also objected to the 100% sales tax on CBD and hemp products, which would drive many businesses that sell them out of business, Omaha State Senator Jen Day said. Fair taxation is always an effort to balance things with raising revenue. The bill is a tax shift, not a new investment in public education, as supporters maintain taxation watchdog groups Open Sky Policy Institute said. On average, 5% of Nebraskans with incomes over $252,600 will pay less as a result of the changes, while for 8 out of 10 Nebraskans, the sales tax increase will on average be greater than any property tax cut they may receive, Open Sky said, citing a study by the Institute of Taxation and Economic Policy. The bill must survive two more rounds of debate by the end of the legislative session on April 18th in order to pass. Pillen has promised to call lawmakers back for a special session if property tax relief efforts fail to pass. Opponents across the political spectrum insist they support finding a way to reduce property taxes, but not with a sales tax increase. And some Republican lawmakers now find themselves at odds with the Republican governor over it. When you increase taxes to cut taxes, you're not actually cutting taxes, Republican State Senator Julie Slama said. I'm all for bringing the band back together and having a special session, if that's what it takes. You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Thursday, April 4th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Mary Vreese Brink. Mary Vreese Brink, age 75, of DeWitt, Iowa, formerly of Alton, passed away on Sunday, March 31st, 2024, in DeWitt. The visitation with the family present will be held from 10:30 to 11:30 a.m. on Friday, April 5th, at the Uhlman Funeral Home in Orange City. There will be a funeral service at 11:30 a.m. on Friday at the funeral home with Reverend Harlan D. Young officiating. Interment will follow the service at the Nassau Township Cemetery near Alton. Mary Kate was born on November 4, 1948 in Lamars, one of the six children born to Doris W. and Blanche Mulder Vreese. She was raised in Alton and attended Floyd Valley Schools. On March 29, 1965, she was united in marriage to Arlen Jean Goslinga. Together, they had two children, Erica and Gina. Arlen passed away on October 25, 1969 in Orange City from polymyositis. In January of 1971, she was married to Jerry Brink. They had two children, Amy and Jared. They first made their home on a farm near Hospers, where they raised livestock, and later in the Princeton and DeWitt areas, where Mary worked as an insurance inspector. Mary was currently a member of Cornerstone Church in DeWitt, and was a previous member of the First Reformed Church in Hospers and the Alton Presbyterian Church. Known for her kindness, compassion, and faithfulness, Mary volunteered at her local elementary school and nursing home, but her greatest joy was spending time with family, especially with her 10 grandchildren and 2 great-grandchildren. Survivors include a son, Eric Goslinga, and his wife, Kathleen of Marshalltown, 2 daughters, Gina and her husband, Paul Tiffany, Fergus Falls, Minnesota, and Amy Lamphers of Kamchi, a daughter-in-law, Jessica Brink of DeWitt, 10 grandchildren, Andrew Lamphers and his wife Tammy of Davenport, Nathan Tiffany of Fergus Falls, Noah Lamphers and his wife Megan of Waukee, Christina and her husband, Jacob Thompson of Austin, Texas, Josiah Tiffany of Winona, Minnesota, Grace Tiffany of Moorhead, Minnesota, Cheyenne Yeomans of Preston, Liam Brink of DeWitt, and Daniel Goslinga and Dalton Goslinga, both of Marshalltown. Two twin great-grandchildren, Knox and Brinley Lamphers, and 2 brothers, Terry Vreese and her twin brother, Michael Vreese, and his wife, Linda. 3 sisters, Stephanie Korber, Doris Beltman, and Lisa, and her husband. Terry Hogson, a sister-in-law, Julie Brink, and her former husband, Jerry Brink, as well as numerous nieces and nephews. In addition to her parents and first husband, she was preceded in death by a son, Jared Brink, a sister-in-law, Tracy Vreese, and 2 brothers-in-law, Kenneth Korber and Dennis Beltman. In lieu of flowers, memorials will be given to Village Northwest Unlimited in Sheldon and Marine Cadets of Iowa, Inc. of Marshalltown. You're invited to leave a message of condolence, print a memorial folder, watch a tribute video, and view a recording of the service at www.uhlman.com, spelled O-O-L-M-A-N. Rodney Arthur Raby. Rodney Arthur Raby is survived by his brother, Rich, who lives in Des Moines, Iowa, and his youngest brother, Donald, that has passed. Rod grew up in the Leeds area. In 1960, he married Mary Margaret Pritchard and moved to the Morningside area. They had 4 children, 2 boys and 2 girls. Pat Raby was their youngest, and Molly Ann Boyinga, Doug, Joyce Van Holland, and Brent, deceased, and Joe Renaby Darlene are also enjoyed 8 grandchildren. Rod worked for Sunshine Foods for many years until they were brought out by Superfoods. Rod was a meat cutter for both stores. He enjoyed hunting in the fall with his sons and fishing. He would take many trips with the boys. He loved being outside and working on the cars. He was a great family man. He will be greatly missed. Patrick Joseph Sullivan. Patrick Joseph Sullivan passed away on March 27, 2024, in Aurora at the age of 75 after a 3-year battle with pancreatic cancer. He was born on March 13, 1949, at St. Vincent's in Sioux City, the 7th of 9 children, to Max and Jake and Brenna Dean Bun Harnett Sullivan. A funeral mass will be held at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, April 6th, at St. Patrick's Catholic Church in Jackson, Nebraska. Visitation will take place 1 hour before the service. Ziemler Moglein Shavata Funeral Homes in Aurora is assisting with the funeral arrangements. Pat served 2 years in the U.S. Army with a deployment to Germany, where he received a National Defense Service Medal. He received certificates of excellence for his military work. He sent quality equipment back to our military guys with a touch of love. Upon his honorable discharge, he returned to his hometown of Jackson to help on the farm and family business, the Lariat Bar. His career began as a union laborer, but an on-the-job accident left him partially disabled. Despite this, he continued to share his mechanical gifts with those around him. Pat's love for the outdoors led him to spend many years exploring the Boundary Waters. He passed on this passion to young people through the TEC, Teenagers Encounter Christ, and imparted his mechanical expertise to his son, Sean, who has since built a successful career using those skills. Pat's involvement with the AA had a profound impact across counties in northeast Nebraska. In his free time, Pat enjoyed traveling to the Boundary Waters, working on mechanical projects, and never lost his love for farming. If Nebraska football was on, he was watching it and sharing his opinion of what might work better. He worshipped at St. Patrick's Catholic Church. Pat is survived by his wife, Celeste of Aurora, Minnesota, his son, Sean and Sue, grandchildren, Abby and Noah, Fritch, Alec and Colin, as well as his siblings, Marcia and Jerry Wisniewski, Diane Sullivan, Bill Sullivan, Mary Kay and Bill Barkley, Mona and Dan O'Neill, Trish and Doug Conklin, and Jim and Mary Sullivan, and many nieces and nephews and relatives, stepchildren, Stephanie, Cindy, and Mary. He was preceded in death by his parents, infant sister Mary Teresa, brother Michael Jerome, sister-in-law Rita Sullivan, and stepson Kyle. May his memory live on in the hearts of those who knew and loved him. Dr. Benjamin Martin. Dr. Benjamin Martin, 90, of Lincoln, formerly of Pender, Nebraska, died Saturday, March 30th, 2024. Visitation is 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. on Thursday, April 4th, 2024, at St. John the Baptist Catholic Church in Pender, with a family sharing of memories and a rosary starting at 7 p.m. Mass is 10 a.m. on Friday, April 5th, 2024, at St. John the Baptist Catholic Church in Pender. Burial with military honors will be in Rose Hill Cemetery in Pender. The lunch will follow at Pender Community Cemetery in Pender. He is survived by 3 siblings, Dennis and Julie Martin, Susie Cohee, Gail and Norbert Holtz. Sister-in-law Irene Martin, children Kim and Bill Benson, Jeff and Donna Martin, Steve and Simone Martin, Janine Martin, Mike and Vianne Martin, Shannon and Doug Carroll, Joni Duncan, Julie and Pat Molina, Jill and Chris Bessemer, daughter-in-law Jill Ruskamp and Randy, and 37 grandchildren and their spouses, and 46 great-grandchildren. Now let's move on to the sports section, starting with some college basketball, Clark's Path Paved by Pioneers, Women's College Basketball Changed by Many. Long before Caitlin Clark broke records, packed arenas across the country, like a Taylor Swift in sneakers and inspired young girls to be like her, women's basketball looked very different than it does today. Until 1997, there was no WNBA. Media coverage was minimal. The madness of March was almost exclusively the men's domain. Born 5 years following the WNBA's launch, Clark has never known anything but what she's helped create, a spectacular game underscored by a record $12.3 million viewers watching Monday's LSU-Iowa rematch in the NCAA tournament, and a sport with room to grow. While Clark has done her part, with every step-back logo three-pointer, a generation of women cleared the way. And as the Final Four roars into Cleveland this week, Clark is there scoring 41 in the regional final to dethrone Angel Reese and the defending champions, the Tigers. Those round ball revolutionaries are getting long overdue salute. More than 40 years later, Nancy Lieberman remembers Billie Jean King assuring her that she was blazing trails. "She told me when I was 22, you're a pioneer," said Lieberman, whose on-court wizardry earned her the nickname Lady Magic and made her a three-time Kodak All-American at Old Dominion, the two-time Olympian and Naismith Hall of Famer. "I'm like, what, a pioneer? I didn't know what she meant. I know what she meant now." It's easy to forget that the 1996 U.S. Olympic team, which jump-started two professional leagues, played in 5,000-seat arenas during the Atlanta Games. And before those leagues launched, women went overseas to play professionally. As Clark rewrote the record books this season while pushing the TV viewership to unimaginable levels and pulling unprecedented attention to the women's game, she steered the spotlight towards stars who preceded her. With the same deft touch as one of her down-court passes for an assist to a fast-breaking teammate, Clark has connected present to past. Before the dynasties at South Carolina, UConn, Tennessee, or Louisiana Tech, there were dominant programs at Delta State and Immaculata University, the first women's national champions in 1972. Clark's run has also illuminated the contributions of some of the sport's giants, greats like Lieberman, Ann Myers, Drysdale, Pearl Moore, Carol Blazkowski, Cheryl Miller, Maya Moore, Lynette Woodard, and many others who laid the foundation for the heights of the game's reach in 2024. These women, some of whom have records that still aren't acknowledged by the NCAA, have been glossed over in these TikTok times. They are forgotten names, and they're only brought up because there's a record that was being broken where we haven't done a great job at historically producing documentaries on history of women's basketball, said South Carolina coach Dawn Staley, who has her undefeated team in fourth straight Final Four. "We have to do a better job," Staley added. "This day and age, we will be documented and told a million times. I hope when that's being told that we pull from the legends, that we're standing on their shoulders, and what they've done should not be forgotten." Many, maybe not household names, like today's top players who have benefited from increased media attention the past two decades, and when NIL didn't mean name, image, likeness, but literally what they receive for playing, they are ones who made everything possible. Barrier busters and some, and then some. Some people play the game and show people changed the game. Lieberman said in a phone interview, "I changed the game. Caitlin has changed the game. Cheryl Miller changed the game. Diana Taussari changed the game. Brittany Griner changed the game. And that doesn't mean you're not a hell of a player. There's a lot of really good players, but how many really changed the game? And how the game has changed. Since 1972, Title IX's historic passing, which at least in theory gave females the same athletic opportunities as their male counterparts, women's basketball has grown from a gym class activity in some places to a global game. Professional leagues with varying degrees of success started and folded before the WNBA, which has blossomed into popularity with these players and teams proudly promoting social activism and inclusion along with playing high-level hoops. For Myers Drysdale, it has been like watching a child learn to crawl, walk, and run. It's hard to imagine, but it wasn't that long ago when women didn't receive athletic scholarships. In fact, Myers Drysdale, who has a highly publicized NBA tryout 45 years ago, was the first to get four-year financial assistance. She was followed by her All-American brother Dave and played at UCLA, a decision that she made casually at a family cookout. David was teammates with Kenny Washington, and Kenny was going to be the women's coach, Myers Drysdale said. They came home for the weekend and said, "How would you like to go to UCLA and play basketball?" I said, "Okay." That was the extent of my recruitment. That memory draws a hearty laugh from Myers Drysdale, who was Clark and LSU Angels Reese's rolled into one. One of the 11 children that she was on the court or anywhere she competed. Along with basketball, Myers Drysdale played softball, badminton, field hockey, tennis, and ran track. So gifted, she won the female version of the ABC's The Superstars and competed in the men's event. During filming, she met her husband, Don, a Hall of Fame pitcher with the Dodgers who died of a heart attack in 1993. Her flirtation with the men's pro game came in 1979 when Myers Drysdale made history as the first female to get an NBA tryout after signing a $50,000 free agent contract with the Indiana. She held her own before being cut by the Pacers after six practices, but her foray on the floor with the men was a pivotal moment of acceptance for women. Doors were beginning to open. I got a lot of publicity with my tryout, she said. It helped. We didn't have podcasts, we didn't have social media, we had the local TV stations, we had local newspapers. You didn't have all the stuff they have today. Lieberman and Myers, Drysdale, don't begrudge the modern player, just the opposite. They lit the torch and proudly passed it along. When they were young, there were no professional star to inspire them, no chartered planes for road trips, no state-of-the-art facilities on college campuses, not even basic equipment. We didn't have trainers or anyone to tape our ankles, said Myers Drysdale, the vice president of Phoenix Mercury. We didn't have practice uniforms. You'd wear the same uniform 2 or 3 years in a row. For Lieberman, the soaring state of women's basketball is a testament to her generation and a new one pushing it higher. In recent years, the 65-year-old has bonded with Clark, and Lieberman finally got to see her play in person last week, when she attended the Superstars home finale in Iowa City. When it ended, Clark presented Lieberman with one of her game-worn jerseys. The greatest thing that has happened to women's basketball for the next level of growth is Caitlin Clark, Angel Reese, and some of those kiddos, Lieberman said. But in particular, what this woman has done, she kinda did this. Some pioneers helped. Going on to another basketball article, Dort leads All-American nods from GPAC. NAIA All-American Basketball. The NAIA Women's Basketball National Championships put a pair of players on the NAIA All-American team while head coach Bill Harsman was named Coach of the Year. Harsman, a fifth-year head coach at Dort, led the defenders to their first women's basketball red banner, with only two losses on the season compared to a program-best 35 victories. This was Dort's fifth appearance in the national tournament in as many seasons and second championship game appearances since Harsman started his tenure during the 2018-2019 school year. At the close of the 2024 season, the defenders ranked number one nationally in a dozen categories. Dort's Macy Sievers was named the first team and Carly Gustafson earned a third team nod. Briarcliff's Connor Sudman was selected for the second team, and Northwestern College's Molly Shannery joined Gustafson on third team. Sievers averaged 12.6 points and nearly 7 assists per game and 6.3 rebounds a contest. She shot 51% on the field, on field goal attempts, and over 37% from the three-point range on 104 tries, and was 78% free throw shooters this season, while also going for 100 steals and 15 blocks. The NAIA National Championship Tournament, Sievers was named MVP. Sudman, a graduate student, compiled 1,834 career points for the Chargers and averaged 14.4 points per game this season with 6.1 rebounds and 3.5 assists a contest as well. Gustafsson, a graduate student, ends as Dort's career leader in total points and total rebounds with 1,976 points and 1,099 rebounds. She averaged 12.4 points and 7 rebounds per game on the defenders' national title run. Shani, a senior, averaged career bests in scoring 17.3 and rebounds 8.7. She earned first-team All-GPAC honors after being an honorable mention All-American last season. Jamie Pickens of Carroll, Montana, was named the 2024 National Player of the Year. Pickens ranked first in the nation in field goals, free throws, defensive rebounds, total rebounds, rebounds per game, blocks, points, points per 40 minutes, and is second in the nation offensive rebounds and points per game. The center notched 25 double-doubles on the season and posted 32 of 34 games in double-digit points. Ella Collar of Martin is the only All-American this year to have named an All-America team four times. Callie Stevens of Lewis Clark State and Grace Beyer of UHSP and Melissa Akulu of Vanguard are three-time All-Americans. Now here's a subheader. Van Calsbeek's men's named the men's to All-American squad. Northwestern College's Alex Van Calsbeek garnered recognition on the NAIA Men's Basketball All-American second team. The Red Raider sophomore averaged 20.6 points, 6.3 rebounds, and 2.7 assists this season on 58.4% shooting on all field goals and over 84% from the free throw line. Elijah Malone of Grace was named Player of the Year. Malone helped guide the Lancers to an incredible 34-2 record this season, as Grace was one of the last four teams standing at the national tournament. Coach of the Year went to Drew Stutz of Freed Hardman. Stutz led the Lions to a comeback victory to win the 2024 Red Banner. Grace's Scott Moore was named Coach of the Year by the National Association of Basketball Coaches. It's the second All-America nod for Malone. The LaGrange, Indiana native recorded 9 double-doubles and is ranked number 13th in the nation in total rebounds and 7th on the defensive side. The senior is also ranked number 1 in the nation in total blocks and led his squad with 17.3 points per game. Let's finish off today with the article Wingert, Grant, and Flemister, College Signings. Three of Sioux City's metro area's best high school basketball players solidified their futures over the past couple of days. On Tuesday, Dakota Valley senior Jackson Wingert verbally committed to the Briarcliff men's basketball program, while Sioux City East seniors Fitzy Grant and A.J. Flemister officially put ink to paper to sign with the Morningside University's men's program. Wingert averaged of nearly 26 points per game and over 8 rebounds an outing this season. He scored 1,384 points and 562 rebounds for his career and was part of two state title winners. On Wednesday, Wingert was named to South Dakota Basketball's Coaches Association All-Star Game, held on April 19th at Sanford Pentagon in Sioux Falls. Wingert was named All-State in Class A this season and was picked most valuable player of the Dakota 12 Conference. The Dakota Valley product follows his older brother, Camden, and father, Torre, to the Chargers men's hoops program. Camden just finished his senior season but has eligibility remaining should he use his extra year due to the COVID pandemic. Grant was also recognized as All-Stater this season in addition to landing on the All-Missouri River Athletic Conference first team. Grant ranked 5th in scoring average among players in the conference at 15.3 points a game while shooting a league-best 61.7% on field goal attempts. He also grabbed 6.6 rebounds and outing to rank the MRAC's top 5 in the category. Flemister also garnered some football offers but opted to join the Mustangs on the hardwood after he went for 7.2 points, 3.6 rebounds, 3.3 assists, and 1.6 steals per game. He had 11 catches for 165 yards and a touchdown for the football team on offense and 8.5 tackles on defense. In addition to Wingert being named to the SDBCA All-Star Game, Vermilion's John Brooks will coach one of the girls' All-Star teams after he led the Tangers to a Class A state title this season. And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Thursday, April 4th. I'm your reader, Will Potter. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.
Roxanne Watson is on a mission.
Hello, how are you doing today?
She wants more people to register as organ, eye, and tissue donors.
Are you an organ donor?
Yes, I am.
Yay! Alrighty.
My goal is to sign up the most people in the United States.
What drives her? Roxanne's own life was saved through the gift of a heart transplant, made possible by an organ donor.
I decided that day that I was going to devote myself to the cause of organ donation and signing people up and honoring my donor by doing that.
Now she's back to health, and she's a powerful force helping to save lives every day through her work. Imagine what you can make possible by leaving behind the gift of life.
8 people can be helped with the major organs, and up to 50 people can be helped with a little bit of everything. And when you think about it that way, that you could help that many people, it's amazing, it really is.
Learn more and sign up as an organ, eye, and tissue donor. Go to organdonor.gov. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Health Resources and Services Administration.